Let's get started. I think that God has a certain sense of humor. I have a bad case of laryngitis today. My very last lecture before I retire. I'll be here next semester, but I won't be teaching. So it strikes me as exceedingly funny in a way that to end up 30 years at Cornell with laryngitis. Before I started, I'm just astounded at these cakes here and delighted. But before I started the lecture, I really wanted to introduce you to my wife, Carol Bear, who's sitting here, and wanted wanted simply to say that if I've achieved anything at all in my years at Cornell, she is the one who deserves the credit. Carol is one of the smartest people I've ever known in my life. She got MS 3 years after we were married. She's a concert pianist and had to give that up. And the way she has dealt with MS, with cheerfulness, with courage, has been probably the greatest inspiration to me of my life. And if I've achieved anything, it's really because of Carol. You may not know this. In fact, I've never said this before publicly, but every year she routinely prays for students in my classes, that God will bless them, that their learning will go well, that they will enjoy the class. And I just want to say, Carol, you've made my life really, really, really good. This is her caregiver, who's been with us for 10 years, Marcia Heisler. And Marcia has also been an incredible blessing to all of us. We have not had such an easy relationship. She's a very feisty woman, and I hate conflict. I love to argue, but I utterly, totally hate interpersonal conflict, and I've had to learn with Marcia to fight right back. And she's become really as a daughter to me in many ways. Her husband, Mike, is sitting behind Carol. And Kathy, Mike's daughter, is sitting between Marcia and Carol. So I welcome all of them here today. I'm also delighted that Jim Tantillo and his wife, Wendy Tarlow, are here. And I want to say that Jim has probably worked with me more over the years than any other single TA. He's clearly been one of the outstanding TAs that I've had in my total years at Cornell. He's now an instructor in natural resources. I hope that the college will be wise enough to try to persuade him to stay on longer term. Jim has been just an absolute delight to me over the years. Greg has worked with me about 5 years and also one of my grad students, and I want to thank you, Greg, for all that you've done in these years. And Rob has been working with the course just 1 year, but also has made some very, very solid contributions. I've been thinking since Tuesday of your last comment in the class, and it somehow really nicely summed up all that we were trying to do. It has been an incredible career. Teaching at Cornell is an incredible privilege, and I've enjoyed, I won't say every minute of it, it's had a few ups and downs, but it's been a wonderful time. As you perhaps have guessed by now, I'm sometimes a bit critical of the university in terms of diversity issues, but it has been an incredible place to teach, and it certainly is one of the world's great universities, and for that I'm extremely grateful. Plato said some 2,500 years ago, the nice thing about being a philosopher is you don't have to be exactly up to date. You can reach back in time. He said, "For we are discussing no trivial subject, but how a man should live." We're discussing no trivial subject, but how a man should live. And it seems to me that this really is what the course has been all about. And I do feel a great sadness in coming to the end of my formal teaching career at Cornell. And I realize that this is the question that I've wrestled with students over the years. We live in a society where we're judged to a large extent by what we achieve. I think probably in the long sweep of things, it's not so much what we achieve, but how we deal with the hand that's been given us, how we negotiate life, whether we do it with justice and graciousness and civility, or whether we do it ill-natured and so on. And I think that that's one of the lessons I've learned here at Cornell as well. These thoughts have come back to me with renewed force the last few years as I've read parts of Gilbert Mailander's book, The Taste for the Other, where he discusses the writings of C.S. Lewis. In his first chapter, which is called The Sweet Poison of the False Infinite, his opening lines are these. He says, "What do we see if we look rightly at our world? We see," C.S. Lewis thinks, "an astonishing cataract of bears, babies, and bananas. This immoderate deluge of atoms, orchids, oranges, cancers, canaries, fleas, gases, tornadoes, and toads. What sort of attitude is appropriate for a human being confronting this astonishing cataract and immoderate deluge of things? We are," Lewis writes in the same context, "to offer nature neither worship or contempt." This is a theme to which Lewis often returns. To be fully human involves a certain stance toward the things of creation, delighting in things without seeking security in them, delighting in things without seeking security in them. Mailander discusses Lewis's concept of Sehnsucht. It's a German term that means a kind of deep longing, Sehnsucht. And he says, for Lewis, this is a mood of intense longing, yet this want is itself felt as a delight. The hunger is better than any other fullness, this poverty better than all other wealth. The experience of almost anything can arouse this inconsolable longing. It seems always to be a longing for something not given in experience. It comes as a byproduct of focusing attention and desire on something else. Hence, Lewis can say, quote, "All joy reminds. It is never a possession. All joy reminds. It is never a possession." Let me read a somewhat long quote from Mailander here, where he's quoting Lewis. This is from page 14 of his book. He says, "Are not all lifelong friendships born at the moment when at last you meet another human being who has some inkling, but faint and uncertain, even in the best, of that something which you were born desiring, and which beneath the flux of other desires and in all the momentary silences between the louder passions, night and day, year by year, from childhood to old age, you are looking for, watching for, listening for. You have never had it. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been but hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if it should really become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away, but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it. Beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, here at last is the thing I was made for. We cannot tell each other about it. It is the secret signature of each soul, the incommunicable and unappeasable want, the thing we desired before we met our wives or made our friends or chose our work, and which we shall desire on our deathbeds when the mind no longer knows wife or friend or work. While we are, this is. If we lose this, we lose all." Mailander argues that the key to understanding the concept of Sehnsucht, a key which Lewis himself was a long time finding, is that it is a longing for something never directly given in experience. This is, in effect, Lewis's description of the restless heart, which Augustine said can rest only in God. To try to satisfy this longing with any object given in experience will be futile and will inevitably spoil the genuine pleasure which the object might have given. The desire to hold on to repeat, to preserve joy, at the deepest level, this will always fail. It's a very important point. The desire to hold on to repeat, to preserve joy at the deepest level, this will always fail. This is the foundational insight in some ways of Buddhist monastics. Chuang Tzu in the writings of Taoism makes a very similar point when he talks about letting life flow. The very first week, the assignment we had when we looked at the woodcarver poem and the useless tree poem, there was a sense of not grasping after things, not being greedy, letting life flow. I believe that this is one of the fundamental points that we find in a variety of religious traditions. Lewis believes that the proper posture for the creature is one of receptivity. Mailander writes this. He says, it is always possible to seek ways to assure ourselves of repeating the pleasure. This is what makes money so suspect in Lewis's eyes. It is a means by which we assure ourselves that we can have pleasure whenever we want it. And he continues, he says, for to treat a created thing as something that we can ultimately possess and control is to destroy its true character. This is so important in relationships. I think my first marriage failed because I was too compulsive about control, too intent on reforming the world, too, including my poor wife, too sure of everything I knew. It says, for to treat a created thing as something that we can ultimately possess and control is to destroy its true character. To seek in any created thing a complete fulfillment of the longing which moves us is to make of it an object of infinite desire, and because it is only a created thing, a false infinite. It may still be sweet, at least for a time, because it is intended by its giver to be a source of delight. But in the end, it will be poison for the person who gives his heart only to it. Hence the constant temptation, the lure of the sweet poison of the false infinite. I want to move this now in a somewhat different direction. As I look back over the semester, it's clear that we've wrestled with some very, very difficult issues and, in a sense, have achieved very few answers. And in a way, the course is designed to do that. The course is really to get us thinking about these important issues and some of the ways to approach them, not simply to give particular answers. People hold very different views about some of these issues concerning how we treat nature. And there are also people of whose actions we strongly disapprove, the exploiters, the polluters, the indifferent. And as I've pointed out a number of times, if we're honest with ourselves, we realize very quickly that we ourselves frequently, often, act in ways that do not always add to environmental health either. It's not easy to lead a consistent life when it comes to how we use and abuse our natural resources. As we look back over the past 50 years in American history, we realize that there was a great deal of enthusiasm after World War II for improving our cities, the great leap forward, urban renewal, all kinds of programs to bring more justice and to help the poor. And some of them have worked exceedingly well. Some of them have not worked all that well. We look back today with some horror at what we did to functioning neighborhoods in some of our inner cities, where although the housing wasn't exactly elegant, these were functioning neighborhoods where people really lived happily together. We tore down some of these neighborhoods and built high-rise buildings, all in the name of the Great Society. And yet, as we look back today, we realize that some of this was a huge failure, perhaps symbolized by St. Louis's housing development, Pruitt-Igoe, which had to be torn down before it was 20 years old because of the just uncontrollable crime rates. If we look at planned cities like Brasilia, the general conclusion is they're fairly sterile. We don't really quite know yet what makes a vital, functioning human community and city. We're learning, I think. But some of the cities that were totally planned have not been all that great. People don't particularly like to live there. They'd much sooner live in Rio or Sao Paulo or one of the other cities that just sort of grew by itself with all of the problems that those cities face. If we look at the incredibly dismal architecture and public buildings, government buildings in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the years after World War II, or I would say even if we look at some of the dismal Bauhaus architecture that sort of colonized our cities. I was looking recently at pictures of some of the Dutch cities and these elegant, elegant older buildings, and then here there are these boxes that just sort of don't seem to fit. What I think we see from all of this is that it's not so easy to reform society. School busing has been a mixed blessing. It's worked in some ways, in other ways it's been a big failure. The war on poverty, has it succeeded or not? It's hard to say. Fewer people perhaps are hungry. Family structure has deteriorated tremendously in some ways. And what I think we see from all of this is that it is a great deal more difficult to plan for the future than we once thought. Vietnam, we thought we were going to really solve problems long term. It turned out to be a kind of national disaster for us. To be sure, there have been improvements, and I think it's important for us to read stuff like Bjorn Lomborg's The Skeptical Environmentalist, because he does show that in some way there have been global improvements in how people eat and safe water and various health factors. But what I think we are facing up to is that in some ways, we're simply not smart enough to know how to bring it all together. And I think this has been a crisis of sorts for planners. In the years after World War II, the big name was planning. Let's plan for the future. Let's do it all right. Let's use science and technology and get it all right. And in some ways, we've failed rather dismally. The temptation, I think, in that kind of situation is to abandon planning and just go back to solving problems one at a time. In some ways, that's safer. I think the problem solvers, in some ways, are likely to do less damage than the large-scale planners. But yet, there's still something about planning and problem solving that keeps us unsure. Problem solving is oriented towards the past. Its function is to restore what was once presumably adequate, but which now for some reason is not functioning properly. Discomfort and guilt are typically the motivating forces pressing people to resolve the problem, alleviate the pain, make the needed correction. Planning, on the other hand, is future-oriented. The planner dreams about what might be. It's a more open-ended process. I would say that although in my own tradition, in the biblical tradition, although the Bible talks a great deal about sin, about human failure, that's not the major emphasis. The major emphasis still is on the coming kingdom of God, a time when there will be peace and justice and even this wonderful vision where the lamb and the lion will lie down together. It's a wonderful dream, even if it doesn't make ecological sense to us. And I think in a way it's would be too bad if we simply move away from planning because we've made such bad mistakes in planning over the years. I think the planning stance has much to commend it, even though it's a very dangerous process for human beings. And I think we have to honestly ask the question, are we smart enough with all of our computers and science and technology to reform everything? And the longer I live, the more skeptical I am that we are. I don't think we should stop trying, but I think we have to maintain a healthy skepticism about our own ability to see the large picture. I think I've just been reading Solzhenitsyn, as I mentioned in the last class, and it is an incredible tale of woe and sorrow and grief and ruined lives that were the victims of the great planners. It just did not work out as the planners had hoped it would. Problem solving is bad enough. We often solve problems at the expense of other life and at the expense of our natural environment. Planning, I think, is even more dangerous. A great deal of human grief has been caused by the overzealous reformers, the self-righteous prophets of the future who knew what was exactly right for everyone else's life, who had these large-scale plans, going all the way back to Rousseau and others, who knew exactly how everyone else ought to educate their children, but treated his own children with utter disregard, treated the women in his life with great contempt, treated his friends shabbily, but he knew exactly how everyone else ought to lead their lives. I think we have to face the fact that in these large-scale plans, we've sometimes run roughshod over the rights and interests of others. So that's the problem we face. Problem solving, in a way, is too oriented towards guilt and failure. Planning is dangerous. Where do we go from here? As I've wrestled with this problem, it has struck me that one possible way to go, and to a considerable degree this comes out of my own background and tradition, would be to take more time before we try to change the world, change other people, even change ourselves, to take more time to celebrate life the way it is. Just to step back and look at the incredible beauty and mystery and wonder and variety of life. One of the great, great pleasures over the years of being a professor has been to see your faces. Your faces are so remarkably interesting. Each one a little different. Your moods are different. Sometimes I get irritated at you because you look bored or you look like you're going to drop off asleep. At other times, you're on the edge of your seats, and it's a wonderful, incredible symbol, in a way, reality of the variety of the world we live in. And I think before we try to change ourselves or other people or the world, let's stop first and just celebrate life. Life is an incredible gift in all of its diversity and variety. And I think if we can only take a little time just to begin to do that, it's not easy. Modern man always needs to be in control. He has what appears to be an almost compulsive need to master, conquer, change the environment. But it seems to me if we can celebrate, if we can give thanks, if we can praise, we might discover that this is possible when we look at the rich variety of life and so much of life that by definition is beyond our control. To the extent that the individual defines herself as a creator rather than a creature, she inevitably enters into a kind of competition with God in the attempt to justify herself. She cannot praise God because she is trying to establish her own security and reputation apart from God. In our serious endeavors to improve life, we easily lose touch with the deeper seriousness, the playfulness, the celebration, the wonder of life itself. The great danger of modern technological society is that we have to find a way to control everything, and everything has to be useful. And that's why we started with that poem, The Useless Tree. Because if there's anything I've discovered over the years, it's that always wanting to be useful or always wanting to produce and achieve is a way to wring all of the joy out of life. Not that those are bad. And one can even have great joy in achieving. There are scientists and writers and others who, where their work and play coalesce. But it's a free kind of achieving, not something that is the compulsive attempt to justify ourselves. And it seems to me that we have to face up to the fact that there is this constant pressure to control and to produce. Look at the dismal qualities of Marxist art and architecture and some of the art and architecture in our own society. Look at the pressures from Madison Avenue, from television, constant discussion of gross domestic product. I heard a phrase, I mentioned this in a previous lecture, by one of our deans, a description of the university as a kind of factory. That wasn't the dean's term. The exact term, I believe, was a knowledge production facility. Sounds like it comes right out of a five-year plan. I think maybe it did. A knowledge production facility? School, scholae in Greek and Latin, the place of leisure? Socrates didn't go off to a knowledge production facility. This was his leisure. This was his passion. It was his joy. And I think if there's anything that has killed life in the university, and I hope there are ways we can communicate this to our new president, it's to see the life of the mind simply in utilitarian terms. The life of the mind is a wonderful thing. It is delightful. It is exciting to think and dream and wrestle with different problems, but it does require a certain amount of leisure. And if we as faculty are judged almost entirely by our production and our published papers and so on, which I'm not against, that's a good thing in itself, but too much of it is not a good thing, we simply don't have the leisure time to spend with you as students, to dream and play with ideas and think about the future. Praise or celebration will free a person to understand things as they are in themselves. For the one who praises must at least temporarily set aside his need to change and improve the world about him. Praise or celebration grows out of that childlike sense of wonder, so typical of the great religious spirits of the ages, of the great artists and musicians, of the great philosophers and appreciators of nature. Now, this part of my thesis I don't think is all that controversial. But as you've seen in the article assigned for this week, I try to extend this even further than that. And this really grew out of a book that I read about 30 years ago, 35 years ago, shortly after I was divorced, a very strange book called Prison to Praise. It was written by an army chaplain, Merlin Carruthers, and I was a pacifist. I still am to some extent, and so an army chaplain wasn't exactly my hero. And furthermore, the book was very badly written. I was finishing up, or had just finished up, my PhD at Harvard, and this was not great theology. This was pretty sloppy stuff. And I read about 10 pages and almost threw it in the trash. It appeared on my desk. I'd never, to this day, know where it came from. But his thesis was very, very interesting. He said that we could learn to praise God not just for the good things in life, but also for the painful and difficult things. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time. But and as I said, I almost threw the book in the trash. But something seemed to grab me, and I kept reading it. And then I got to a little story told about an army wife whose husband was an alcoholic. And every night he would come home and either was drunk when he got home or would get drunk before the evening was over. He was very rough with the kids. He beat them occasionally. He was rough with her. And it was just a miserable, miserable situation. She came to see Merlin Carruthers and told him her troubles. And then after they talked for about 15 or 20 minutes, he turned to her and said, "Have you thought of thanking God, of praising God for the fact that your husband's an alcoholic and giving you all this grief?" She wasn't quite sure she had heard him correctly. She said, "What did you say?" And he repeated himself. And she thought, "This guy is nuts," you know? And she was just about to get up and leave. But something grabbed her, and she stayed there, and they talked just a little more. And before she left, she said a simple prayer thanking God for the fact that her husband was an alcoholic. Well, she went home that night, and when she got home, her husband arrived shortly afterwards, and he wasn't drunk. Now, that wasn't uncommon. He quite often arrived home not drunk. But what was uncommon is that he didn't drink anything the whole evening, nor the next day, nor the rest of the week. This was really, really strange. And after about 2 weeks of this, she went back to see Chaplain Carruthers, and she said, "Don't you think you better talk with him again? You know, this is working great. Maybe you better have another chat with my husband." And he said, "I haven't talked with your husband. I haven't even met him. I don't know him." She said, "Wow, this is strange. This is a real miracle." Well, I know enough about psychology. I worked for a few years at the Project on Religion and Mental Health at Harvard, and I studied some courses in grad school in that area, to know that it's just possible that when he came home that evening, he sensed a change, maybe subliminally sensed a change in his wife, that there wasn't that same critical spirit, that something had shifted just a little bit. And this may have been just enough to break whatever compulsive need he had to be the bad little boy, to test the parents' love, to test his wife's love. The technical term, it was decathected, it was broken. I don't know. You never know in these cases. But whatever happened, a change took place in his life. Well, I read that, and this was so interesting to me that I kept reading. And then not too long after I came to Cornell, I preached a sermon in Sage Chapel on this subject and was just astounded that for the next month or two, faculty and staff and students kept coming to my office wanting to talk about it. And then I began to practice this discipline of praise in my own life. First of all, thanking God for all the things in myself I didn't like. And then thanking God for the things I didn't like in other people. And so on and so on. And what I found was quite amazing. I found that much of that supercritical spirit that is so much a part of me began to soften a little. I wasn't quite so interested in changing everybody and myself. And the thing that I also found is that I began to change and people around me began to change. that instead of just trying to accept myself and force myself to accept other people, when I began to stop doing that and began simply to celebrate their lives, celebrate their existence, even when they were real SOBs to me, you know, even when they were a royal pain, some wonderful things began to happen. I still don't understand what goes on. Here are a few thoughts that clarify it. This has nothing to do with your feelings. This is a discipline. And what I learned as I then began to explore this in more of a research mode is that this is a theme which is found in many religious traditions, and it's found within Judaism, Christianity, it's found among the Taoists and Buddhists and others. Stop trying to change everything and start celebrating life, even the difficult things in life. Here are a few qualifications that are important. And again, I speak out of my own tradition. You have to translate this and see if it can make any sense to you. In the first place, God does not necessarily will evil for our lives. There's a distinction between God's directive will and his permissive will. Secondly, this is not a psychological trick or a religious gimmick, a kind of power of positive thinking designed to make a person like or accept what he really hates. Third, it's not an invitation to masochism, encouraging one to welcome or even seek pain and suffering. And fourth, it's not a theological formula for getting God to change his mind and help us out of difficult situations. Nor is it a denial, in the fifth place, of the reality of evil. And then finally, I would add one of these of my own. These were all things I found in the literature. I have learned over the years that I have never been free to thank God for evil situations that don't somehow impinge on my life. And I've talked with others, and they've found this also to be the case. I've never found that it made sense to thank God for the napalming of children in Vietnam or for the Holocaust or things like that, but only things that somehow directly or indirectly impinge on my own life. Now, if you ask what all this means, I have to honestly say, I don't know. It still doesn't make logical sense to me that we could develop an attitude that would permit us to celebrate life in its totality. But what I found is that the theme is amazingly widespread. William Law, an 18th century clergyman, says, if anyone could tell you the shortest, surest way to all happiness and perfection, he must tell you to make it a rule to yourself to thank and praise God for everything that happens to you. For it is certain that whatever seeming calamity happens to you, if you thank and praise God for it, you turn it into a blessing. Helen Keller, who was born blind and deaf, or she became totally blind and deaf not long after her birth, wrote, I thank God for my handicaps, for through them I have found myself, my work, and my God. I have many other quotes here. I'll skip them. Nietzsche, of all people, and this came as an enormous surprise to me, Nietzsche says, to have joy in anything, one must approve everything. Or he says in another place, if it be granted that we say yea to a single moment, then in so doing we have said yea not only to ourselves, but to all existence. Now don't ask me to explain that logically. It does not make sense to me. And it's not an attempt to deny the reality of suffering, pain, and evil. What I think is involved in it is somehow a very, very deep affirmation of the goodness of life in its totality, with all of the pain and suffering and evil and disappointment, that if one can somehow find a way to affirm life in its totality, it seems to me that some very, very good things happen. And what I have found, even in terms of various social causes that I'm involved in, is that I usually try to take time before getting involved to thank God for my enemies, to celebrate the existence of people that I think are a royal pain and are making this a worse world. Don't ask me why I do this. all that I know is when I take time to celebrate other people's lives, that the polarization is less. And this is something I desperately need because I am a very critical person at heart. I haven't overcome it a long ways. God isn't by any means done with me. I can be a real, I won't say, a really mean person when this critical spirit gets going. But I found that if I can pull back and not be so zealous to change myself, to change my friends, to change the world, but first celebrate the existence of what is, overall life seems to be incredibly better. I don't think this is a kind of Pollyanna optimism, because in my own tradition, in the Jewish tradition and the Christian traditions, there is the suffering servant symbolism, there's the crucifixion of Jesus story, and so on. Evil is not treated trivially. But it seems to me that there is something in this idea of celebration that I just simply cannot avoid. I'm intrigued with the idea that God remembers all the good that ever manifests itself and transforms ultimately all the evil. I believe that whenever there is truth, beauty, gentleness, goodness, kindness, strength, courage, joy, dancing, these become forever part of the very fabric of the universe, for God always remembers them, but the evil he always forgets. I was trying to find a metaphor for that, and I was struggling hard, and I finally came up with a metaphor that God is like the great cosmic compost pile. I don't want to offend any of you if this seems a bit too earthy, but it seems to me that the whole story of the Bible in my own tradition is that God, and as a Christian I would say through Jesus Christ, takes the pain and evil and suffering of the world into his own being and transforms them. And it's just like in the kitchen. If you leave all the garbage in the kitchen, if you leave all your hatred and resentment and pain and suffering and bitterness inside of you, after a while, like the garbage, it's going to stink and it's going to corrupt your life. But if we release it to the process of the compost pile, if we allow God to take it into his own being, it seems to me these very painful experiences in our lives become the seedbed of new beauty and new growth. This has been the story of my own life. It was a tragic experience for me to go through an unwanted divorce. But when I was finally able to accept what had happened and even give thanks for it, it became the ground and the basis of much beauty in the years that took place after that. Let me just close, and Jim asked me to stop. I'm going a little over time, but I just want to read once more this wonderful passage from Thomas Merton, and I'll close with this. He says, "What is serious to men is often very trivial in the sight of God. What in God might appear to us as play is perhaps what he himself takes most seriously. At any rate, the Lord plays and diverts himself in the garden of his creation. And if we could let go of our own obsession with what we think is the meaning of it all, we might be able to hear his call and follow him in his mysterious cosmic dance. We do not have to go very far to catch echoes of that game and of that dancing. When we are alone on a starlit night, when by chance we see the migrating birds in autumn descending on a grove of junipers to rest and eat, when we see children in a moment when they are really children, when we know love in our own hearts, or when, like the Japanese poet Basho, we hear an old frog land in a quiet pond with a solitary splash, At such times, the awakening, the turning aside of all values, the newness, the emptiness, and the purity of vision that make themselves evident provide a glimpse of the cosmic dance. For the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. The more we persist in misunderstanding the phenomena of life, the more we analyze them out into strange finalities of our own, the more we involve ourselves in sadness, absurdity, and despair. But it does not matter much, because no despair of ours can alter the reality of things or stain the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there. Indeed, we are in the midst of it, and it is in the midst of us, for it beats in our very blood, whether we want it to or not. Yet the fact remains that we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity to the winds, and join in the general dance. Jim.